Good morning, good morning. Servant Sunday is when you bring a lamb to the parking lot and that we have the annual reminder of the Old Covenant. Doves, turtle doves, if you're out of work, turtle doves are fine. We are at Daniel chapter 7. And as usual, we've been doing two chapters at a time, and I sort of suspect we probably should slow down a little bit here and do just chapter 7 today, probably. The office over there, the notes I see ran 21 pages today, and I suspect that cripples the church office totally, and they don't get anything else done. This is a great... We've had a number of these very dramatic things. Daniel in the lion's den, and Daniel's friends in the flaming hot furnace. And last week we had Belshazzar's feast on the night that Babylon fell to the Medes and Persians in 539 B.C. And Belshazzar died that night, and in came the Medes and Persians. So we've had a lot of things that have a practical impact. Now we're getting into some of the more visionary prophetic sections. And chapter 7 actually jumps earlier in time. It jumps back in the first year of Belshazzar's reign. Belshazzar and his father Nabonidus were co-regents. Nabonidus was out of town fighting battles and doing various things for the kingdom, and Belshazzar was kind of the governor of Babylon. And so we're jumping back in time to the beginning of Belshazzar's reign, and that would be a time period of about 14 years in which the last the ruler of Babylon's in power. So we're jumping ahead way back into the past. Nebuchadnezzar has been dead about 10 years now. This events here would come some 50 years after the great dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar had a great dream early in his reign. Daniel and his friends had just gone through his training program. And Daniel had the great dream of a tall image with a head of gold, with a chest of silver, with the thighs of bronze, with legs of iron and feet of iron and clay. And Daniel interpreted that dream to be a picture of the world powers which would follow, beginning with Babylon as the great world empire, followed by the Medes and Persians and the Greeks and the Romans, in that order. And it all the way down to the end of history, when a stone cut without hands would smash this image, and the King of Kings would set up a kingdom that lasts forever. And Daniel correctly interpreted that dream. That's 50 years now before this chapter. Chapter 7 would appear to be an exact parallel to chapter 2, if you look at it. And there's some interesting little problems in this chapter that we'll deal with as we go through. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream. Here we get a Daniel having a dream. Dream singular and visions, plural, of his head while on his bed. In other words, all night long he's tossing and turning and seeing a vision with many chapters. And he writes down the dream. If you ever keep track of your dreams, you know, you have to jot them down first thing in the morning or they'll quickly fade from your memory. And if you're into dream interpretation, that's one of the gruels. Well, this is, of course, such a heavy duty series of dreams and visions, he's not going to forget it, but he takes notes and writes it all down in detail, and it proves to be a dream from God of great impact, great importance. Daniel spoke later on, having written this down, saying, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." That's beginning. Now, the great sea ordinarily means the Mediterranean, and ordinarily means those nations that surround the Mediterranean Sea, with Israel being at the far eastern end. Four winds of heaven stirring up the sea. It sounds like the agencies of God moving from the four winds. It sounds like God stirring up the sea. And the sea in general is a symbol of the nations of the world, the restless sea of the Gentile nations, always stirred up in storms of one kind or another. That's biblical imagery of the ocean stirred by the winds. And now four great beasts come up out of the sea. each different from the other. Now, we, instead of getting a image of a great statue made out of various metals, we get some wild animals, and evidently these animals have something to do with nations, only they're wild beasts. Secular history of the nations talks about one great world civilization coming after another and all the great advances and progress in civilization and how wonderful human beings are. And the biblical picture of nations is like they're more like wild, voracious animals, devouring each other and being destructive. That's kind of God's view of things. The four great beasts come up out of the sea, each different from one another. So this would be great world civilizations, great nations rising as God desires. The first was like a lion, and it had eagle's wings. I watched until its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. What great nation do you suppose that might symbolize? Well, if this is following the exact parallel of chapter 2, then that's Babylon, the great. And the winged lions are on the gates of the city of Babylon anyway, and you've seen perhaps in the British Museum, I think they've stolen some of these lions with wings on them. And what about this image of a man standing on his feet, given a man's heart? What does that suggest to you? It suggests the humbling and the conversion of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay? That would be logical, and that fits in. Now, there's one little problem here that you might want to think of. The Babylonian Empire is very near its end at the time this dream occurred. Nebuchadnezzar's been dead 10 years, and 14 more years Babylon is all over with, and it's strange that Daniel would have a dream like this near the end of the Babylonian Empire. Right away, that suggests that perhaps there's some future nation that looks like this coming on the world scene. In your notes today, I gave you Ray Stedman's view, which is a minority view on this chapter, and then I gave you James Montgomery Boyce's standard conservative interpretation of this chapter, because they're a little bit different. Now, Ray Stedman is never wrong, as far as I can tell. Those of us who follow him are always looking for some little mistake he made someplace, and this is the one that comes closest to being a mistake, but I doubt it. So Ray would say, these four nations are nations that will be on the stage of the world at the end of the age. Let's see if that all makes sense. Not only historic nations, not only Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome in the historical sequence, but also four great world powers that are all significant at the time that the Lord comes back. You remember when in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, the image of the beast stood intact until the smiting stone came and smashed it from the feet, and then the whole thing collapsed. And somebody here in the class raised the possibility that each of these world powers had influence on its successors down to the end of the age, and I think that's sound. So we'll just have to hold this material in a little bit of tension here as we go, because there's a little note of uncertainty regarding the influence these nations might once again have in history as we draw near the end of the age. We'll see how that goes. Is Babylon a great world power right now? Well, probably not. That's Iraq. But what is going to happen in the years ahead of time in Iraq? Is Persia significant today? Well, yes, Persia is. Persia is modern-day Iran. Iran's got a lot of oil wealth and a lot of military prowess and nuclear weapons and things like that. All right. The second wild animal, verse 5, suddenly, and of course the Babylonian kingdom fell suddenly, one night. We saw that last week when Belshazzar was deposed in one night because the armies drained the river and came under the walls. Suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they... I don't know who that is. They said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. What is the second nation here? Well, it would seem to be the Medes and the Persians, okay? And this is, the Medes and Persians are like a bear. What's the difference between why would you use a symbol of a lion with wings for Babylon, and then now you use a bear? and a bear that's on one side, and it's chewing on three ribs of an animal of some kind. And this bear is devouring much flesh. Bears have a lot of just raw strength, don't they? Raw strength and power. Whereas a winged lion is more swift in its activity and its actions. People have wondered what these three ribs stand for, and it's true that the Medes and Persians were once two separate empires, and they combined forces, and right away early in the early history of the Medes and Persians, they conquered good parts of Turkey, Lydia, and Egypt and Babylon, and that may be the three ribs. That Turkey, Egypt, and Babylon may be the three ribs here. That sort of makes sense, okay? All right, then. After this, I looked. By the way, five times in this chapter, Daniel says, I looked, I watched, I observed. So this is a complicated dream, so he has to sort of take it all in. This is a dream with chapters to it. After this, I looked, and there was another beast, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings, like a bird. The beast had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Next empire would be Greece. Why the winged leopard? Great speed and great agility. And what's the history going on here? What happened to the great Persian Empire? The Persian Empire became a great and mighty empire. And on the handout sheet, I gave you a little map showing the territorial district that was ruled by these great world powers. And the Persians were all over the place with great, strong, invincible armies. And the Persians tried to invade Greece and got the Greeks very upset. And what did the Greeks finally do about it? They fought back. And what year? Who fought back? Alexander, son of Philip of Macedon. The Greeks nation was originally city-states, and they finally got together and united. And young Alexander, just as a teenager, began to be a very good soldier. And now in his 20s, he takes charge of the army and takes on the Persians. The small Greek army takes on the Persians swiftly. And how long did it take for the Greeks to overrun the Persians and wipe them out? About 3 years. Incredible. There was a program on the History Channel the other night of this battle, of this war between the Greeks and the Persians. It was really very, very fascinating, the long history of this period in time in history. How far did Alexander go in sweeping over the Persian Empire in a few years' time? Where did he get to? He got all over the known world, the known practical world, that is, as far as India and Egypt, got down to Egypt, and he visited an oasis down there and decided he should be one of the pharaohs, so he had himself named Pharaoh. And the guy's 33 years old, and he gets to Babylon, and he has a drunken party and dies, and he's very despondent because there's no more worlds left to conquer. And they put him in a big glass coffin and take him down to Egypt and bury him there in splendor. And one of the mysteries is where the tomb of Alexander is in the city of Alexandria to this very day. He died. It could be that somebody put a knife through him, but he died drunk, essentially. Unmarried and maybe even gay. There's some good reason to think he might have been, but he had no wife and he had no sons and no heirs. So when he dies, who's going to inherit the kingdom? It has to be divvied up with four of his generals, which is the next part. So we look, there was another, a leopard that had four wings. That would suggest the four generals who will follow him. But the four generals are not terribly important until after Alexander's dead. So that's kind of interesting. But this may be a leopard. It also could be a panther. The Hebrew would allow either one. It could be a panther. Four heads. Its dominion was given. Dominion was given to it. That is, by God's power, Alexander has this ability to overrun the Persians. Now, after this, I saw in the night vision. Oh, I made a little anecdote here. Alexander swept through the whole through Turkey, through Palestine, through Egypt, unstopped and unhindered, with everybody in fear of him, and he just took over whatever he wanted. And he came down and thought Jerusalem would be a nice prize. And we have a story from Josephus, who said that when the priests in Jerusalem got word that Alexander was on the way to destroy Jerusalem, the high priest put on his garments and his and took the scroll of Daniel down to meet Alexander on the seacoast and read Alexander this part of Daniel about himself and said, "Daniel, this is all about you." And Alexander was so impressed with what Daniel had said about him that he spared Jerusalem and caused it to prosper and protected it from destruction. Now that's anecdotal. That's from Josephus, who's sort of reliable. And it'd be good. Anyway, that seems to be reasonable. Anyway, we got the fourth beast. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, not like any known animal. No other animal like this animal. The other animals are reasonable animals that we know from the zoo. This animal is dreadful and terrible and very strong. It has huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. This is worse than Godzilla by quite a bit here. This would be, in our traditional way of looking at it, would be the Roman Empire. What about the Roman Empire? How did the Roman Empire operate? By strong military force. How did the Romans do when they moved into a new conquered territory? What did they do? Burn the fields, yeah? Take a lot of prisoners? What do you do with the prisoners? Or make them slaves. You have 60% of the Roman Empire is slaves, so you got a nice lot of slaves that are captive and rule by force. These are not nice. Romans are not nice in their suppression and rule over the whole known world. So we've got that fits. Huge iron teeth, lots of military power and strength, devouring, breaking in pieces, dividing up kingdoms and nations and incorporating them into its great big empire that eventually will ring the whole Mediterranean. And that empire is the last of these great world empires. And it has 10 horns. What's a horn? It's not the kind of the trumpet type horn. It's the horn that's on the animal that stands for a king. Kings. Leaders. Okay? 10 horns. I was considering these horns on this ferocious beast. And there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there, in this horn, were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. Now that's very mysterious, isn't it? Sounds like there's some kind in history when there's 10 kings running around in what was once the Roman Empire, and then an 11th comes up into power, and the 11th king comes up into power and overruns or plucks up 3 of the 10 horns, and that makes a total of 8 horns now. And this particular 11th horn is a horn speaking great things, pompous words. That doesn't seem to fit anything in history so far down to the... We don't know anything about the Roman Empire that looks like this. Well, there's some pretty bad Caesars down through the history of the Roman Empire. Well, that's puzzling. Now, we get a little interlude here. So while we're thinking about this, we get this little interlude that starts at verse 9. I watched until thrones, plural, I watched until thrones were put in place. Daniel suddenly gets a vision into heaven. And the Ancient of Days was seated. His garments were white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. There we have the same kind of throne, chariot throne that Ezekiel had, with the wheels within wheels turning in every direction. and one called the Ancient of Days is seated on the throne with the white garment and head like pure wool, and fiery flames coming out from around the throne. Fiery stream issued and came forth from him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The angels? Okay. Angels around him. And the court went into session and the books were opened. The court went into session and the books were opened. Over the court was seated. That's awesome, isn't it? An awesome scene in heaven when suddenly the court sits over to administer judgment and justice to the whole universe. And the books are open. What do you suppose these books are? Books, plural. Record of everything everybody's done in exact minute detail, all on Apple iBooks. Or the equivalent. Lots of books. Lots of books by that, and God's keeping detailed accounts of everything going on. I watched then, Daniel says, verse 11, I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. That's this 11th king. I watched until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given over to the burning flame. Now this fourth beast gets thrown into the fire and burned right up. That doesn't seem to have happened yet. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a time and a season. The influence of these three preceding empires, they're not destroyed suddenly the way the fourth beast is, and they have their influence is pervasive right on down to the end. There's one of the little puzzlements in this chapter. They don't just disappear from history and cease to have any influence, apparently. Or these nations come into power and have a revived influence at the end of the age again. Aha! Where are we now in time? Well, let's see if we can get out of the chapter. One of the good things in these visions is Daniel usually gets some help from an angel or from somebody to help him understand the meaning of the dream. So let's look at the timing as we move on. Verse 13. Daniel says, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. Then all peoples, nations, and languages, that all peoples, nations, languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. This is Old Testament. This is the book of Daniel. What is unusual about this section that we've just read? There's a bunch of unusual things in here. Well, we have this title, Son of Man, which Jesus used of himself. Here's the place where that comes from. It comes from what the Son of Man is. What does the Son of Man do here? He goes up to the Ancient of Days and is given some kind of authority. Anything elsewhere in the Bible on that extra credit? It's Revelation chapter 4 and 5, isn't it? Same identical scene in Revelation 4 and 5, and this, the one seated on the throne has the seven-sealed scroll written on the front and the back with seven seals, and the Father seated on the throne says, here's the scroll, who is worthy to open it? Yeah. Yeah. This is all New Testament apocalyptic imagery, the same thing we see elsewhere. And in Revelation 4 and 5, there's this search around heaven for the one worthy to take the scroll and open it, and no one is found. And John, writing Revelation, says, I wept. No one was found worthy to take the scroll and open it. And then somebody brought up the fact that, no, there was somebody worthy to open it, and it was the slain lamb. It was the lamb slain from the foundation of the world. He was worthy. And Jesus comes up and takes the scroll from the hand of the Father and begins to open it. And as he opens the scroll, the great judgments of the book of Revelation unfold on the earth. What does that scroll stand for, I suppose? It's kind of like the title deed of the earth, isn't it? It's kind of like the right to rule the right to rule as earth's legitimate king? Well, here it is in Daniel. See that in Daniel? The Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. There's the Shekinah glory again. That's the splendid supernatural presence of God. And coming to the Ancient of Days, the Father, and to the Son of Man is given the dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all nations and languages should serve him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom the one which will not be destroyed. Well, that's pretty clear then that we have in the coming in of the King of Kings, who we know to be Jesus now from the New Testament. Here it is in Daniel, very clear. And obviously the kingdom that comes in is the one that replaces all these previous kingdoms. Well, that hadn't happened yet then, right? I didn't read the news this morning, but I don't think it happened then tonight. No, it hadn't happened yet. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. Now, Daniel's about 68 years old now. He looks back to he remembers the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, and that was heavy-duty dream. And this is a dream that's upsetting and disturbing to this godly man. And so it's probably a very momentous dream, which indeed has a lot to do with the future. Not just the immediate future, but the long-term future of the whole of mankind. All right, so therefore, if we take the Stedman view, all of these four nations will have a significant place on the scene of the stage of the world history at the close of the age we live in now. That'd be Stedman's view, which I tend to agree with. But also, these are also four historic powers that have had dominion over the earth, ending with the Roman Empire. And more about the Roman Empire later. And Daniel says, verse 16, I came near to one of those who stood by. Daniel's puzzled, and he comes to one of the angels and ask him the truth of all this. And he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. Now here's where we get a little bit of help. Those great beasts, which number four, are four kings which arise out of the earth, or kingdoms. So that's clearly nations that are significant down through world history in the Gentile world. That's obvious. Okay. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and ever. Oh, there's something new here that we didn't know from any other thing in the whole Bible very clearly. Who gets to inherit the earth and who gets to rule with the Messiah? God's people do. In this case, it would be the saints. The saints of the Most High would be the believers of Israel at this point in history. But here now we see that the saints are ruling with the Messiah when he comes. That's new. Daniel says, I wish to know more about the truth concerning the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with teeth of iron and nails of bronze, which devoured, broke in pieces, and trampled the residue with its feet. And I'd like to know about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about the other horn, this 11th horn, which came up, before which three fell, namely, that horn which had eyes and a mouth and which spoke pompous words, whose appearance was greater than his fellows. This king that seems to stand above all the other kings with his pompous, charismatic appearance and pompous words. I was watching, and the same horn was making war against the saints and prevailing against them. So this 11th king is a bad guy. He decides to go persecute Christians. And indeed, Nero did that. But that's not the whole story. He prevails against the saints until the Ancient of Days came and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. That hadn't happened yet? Hadn't happened yet. Thus, he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all of the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. That so far, that sort of fits the Roman Empire and its ability to assimilate and dominate and break up incorporate everything into its vast, big system of government and jurisprudence and culture and religion and everything so far? The United States has sort of assimilated all these cultures and more. Now, the ten horns are ten kings who shall arise from this kingdom. Now, that seems to have not happened yet in history. Seems to be a big gap here. At the beginning of verse 24, one of those gaps in the Old Testament is called the Great Parentheses, when you skip over a whole bunch of history and you go all the way down to the time of the end. See if that makes sense. The ten horns are ten kings, and they will arise at a future day out of this Roman Empire, and another, one of them, will arise after them, and he will be different from the first ones, and he will subdue three kings. So we have a king here who seems to overrule three kings. He will speak pompous words against the Most High, blaspheming of God, open, insulting, blaspheming God. He will persecute the saints of the Most High. He will intend to change the times and the law. Now, that's puzzling. I'd like to have your ideas and suggestions on that. That is a very interesting topic. And for extra credit, a few of you would like to write essays on that. What will this bad guy do to change the times and the law? Does that change natural law? Does that mean change the calendars? Times, that's right, seasons of, yeah, change the course of world affairs, yes. Yeah, the law, the word law is singular here, so that does sound like natural law or the law of Moses or something. Maybe he'll rewrite history. There's a lot of that going on now, the denial of the Nazi Holocaust and the Muslims are denying that the Jews ever had a significant place in Jerusalem ever, and it's always been theirs. And so that goes on all the time. He will speak pompous words against the Most High. He will persecute the saints of the Most High. He will intend to change the times and laws. Then the saints will be given into his hand for a time and times and half a time. Then the believers in God will be handed over to his more or less total power for, how much is a time and times and half a time? 3.5 years. Has that happened yet? No. Terrible persecutions of the church by the early Caesars, but nothing that quite fits this right. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion. That the judges in the court will take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it. Whose dominion is taken away? The dominion of this 11th king. This 11th king is a really bad guy, and he has a great deal of influence over the whole world as a kind of a new Caesar, and he deliberately sets out to change the whole culture and goes to war against all people who believe in God. Now, that's in the book of Revelation. That same sort of theme comes up again, book of Revelation. So who is this guy, we'd call him? We call him the Antichrist. There's actually two bad guys on the world scene. In Revelation 13, one of these is called the beast out of the sea, and the other is called the beast out of the land. And this guy here would be the beast out of the sea, the beast who has political, military clout. If this is part of the Roman Empire, then what are these ten kings about, maybe? Today, if it was all beginning to happen around us in this day, then how would we fit that into contemporary history, this so far? One world government, one world European government, European community, common currency, European community of nations. How many nations in the European community of nations now? More than 10, isn't it? It keeps changing all the time. It might settle down to be 10. You could imagine a bad guy coming up in Europe someplace and and taking over, yeah. The fluid borders in Europe. Yeah, you can easily assimilate and divide and so on. Now, the Roman Empire, the image in chapter 2 had two legs. Remember that? this big beast, the image of the statue, had two legs, an eastern and a western branch. Well, the Roman Empire divided into two branches about what year, about when? Peter had that right last time. I've forgotten already. Well, someplace around then. Remember, Constantine made Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, and he kind of moved his seat of authority over to Constantinople, and the church divided, the Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church split and divided, and we began to have Russia had a czar all the way until 1917, and the Germans had a Kaiser all the way to 1917, the year Ray Edmund was born, and that was in that year both of these czars died, which is why Ray was born that year. He says, Ray Edmund, you'll have to ask him when you see him what that's. All right then, so if we were to combine, if we were to put this, try to put this in Europe, we might miss something. This is a little bit too hard for us to quite, because the Roman Empire is much more than the European community of nations. You may have Russia involved in it. It can have Turkey involved in it. Right now, the role of Turkey in the European community is all up for lots of discussion. Turkey is kind of a liability financially to the Western community. It's a Muslim nation primarily, but it has a democratic government that's officially not Muslim, which is a big plus. So Turkey is, it's hard to say which way Turkey is going to go. Everything's is very fluid right now. But it's an interesting time in history because 100 years ago, none of this was happening. 150 years ago. The court will be seated and they will take away his dominion to consume and to destroy it. So this guy is the bad guy because he has military and political clout, so we'd ordinarily call him the Antichrist, except there's another bad guy in Jerusalem at the same time who's a false Messiah, and the two of them are in cahoots together. And in next chapter, we get the other guy, the other beast. The kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people and the saints of the Most High. That is, the rule of all of the nations of the world will be handed over to God's people under Messiah. That certainly has not happened, has it? Yet. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. This is the end of the account. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts greatly troubled me, and my countenance changed, but I kept the matter in my heart. Very provocative, upsetting dream for Daniel. And he writes it all down and thinks about that. Okay? Now, what do you think about all this? I'm tempted. We could go right on into chapter 8, and I think that might be overload. We probably should save that. Because there's a whole new set of stuff in there, and you need to digest this, get it definitively settled so you know right where you are in world history. No way. Yes. That's exactly what happened. I looked through about a dozen commentaries this week just to see who, what the positions are on this by evangelicals. They're one group of people. Now, the more liberal scholars would say, Daniel wrote this, this is late. Daniel could not have known the future, so this is not an early book like it's supposed to be. And I discard that point of view as incorrect. Daniel lived at the time we think he did here in this time period. The evangelical scholars all take the traditional view of Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome in historical significance, and then a revival of the Roman Empire at the end of the age. So all the conservative scholars say that. What Ray suggests, now Ray's sermons are 1967, I think. They're really dated. His short series on Daniel is a long time. So where you live in history is how you look at the world around about you. So now, what about... Yeah, Steve?
Oh, I was just going to say, I recall reading that Daniel 7 was very popular at the time of Jesus, and all the witnesses were celebrating the Messiah. And so it was kind of like the first to a scrolling
Yes?
himself,
It's true. And that's Israel had a whole bunch of false messiahs running around they always had to deal with all the time. A few years ago, 20, 30 years ago, if you looked at this and you look at the world stage, what might you say about who are the leading nations on the stage? 20, 30 years ago. Russia, the United States, Great Britain. Great Britain, now they have lions in Trafalgar Square, don't they? I think they do. Big lions. And Britannia rules the waves, and at the height of the colonial age, England had it worldwide influence everywhere. So you'd pick England out. It's very logically one of these great powers. Yeah.
Is it okay if you outside the bond here?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Well, if we start with Babylon, what the religion of Babylon is none of those. It's thoroughly pagan. We don't know that. I think it's good to do that. I think that's how you narrow into what's probably the right way, what the limits are. Hinduism and Buddhism don't obviously seem to fit in here anywhere. And I came up a couple of weeks ago that Islam doesn't seem to sit in this succession. It seems to be that mankind's about Western civilization. Money and sex and power. Yeah, quiet behind the scenes. The influence of religion. Yeah, because each one of these cultures, regardless, is carrying its own religion along with it, and that's being spread through the subsequent generation. Now, that's why when you get to the last book of the Bible and we get Mystery Babylon the Great, we get this spread of world religion and spread of commercial democratic values that comes out of the wellspring of Babylon and pollutes the whole world. So the religious aspect is important, yes. It does. Especially, and look at this guy here. This guy is strongly anti the true religion. So that's worth thinking about. Chris? Well, now, down through history, I think particularly some of the reformers were sure that this Antichrist was the Pope. People today would like to press that view again, that the papacy is the Antichrist. Well, these are kings. At all, yeah. Yeah. Chuck Missler's got some good stuff on that. He researches it rather much and rather carefully, and he's got quite a few good... His briefing packages that give you a view of the way the world looks right now. Yes, ma'am. Yes, we do know from Revelation 17. It does appear that that a new world religion will come along with the new world government for a season. The new world religion has to be tolerant towards all other religions, and so that's in the picture. But Jesus has to be excluded because he's divisive. Yeah. Yeah. And now the very term Antichrist can mean opposed to Christ. It can mean instead of Christ. It can mean a counterfeit. A king, wasn't that the basic problem in the Garden of Eden? Eat this fruit and you will be like God. You can be your own God. Suppose God turned the world over to a man who really thought he was God and he could run things for us. and he was a total counterfeit. Then that's kind of where history's headed, isn't it? Didn't seem to be headed toward that kind of thing. One world religion, one God. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Yes, yeah, I can remember that. Syria came into power in 1944. Egypt came into independence in 1957. Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia have all become rich in the last 100 years or less from the oil. So those nations didn't even exist a while ago. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's still people. Yes, I think that's ten successive forms of government followed by an 11th. I think that I've lost touch of that, but it's in Revelation. Yeah. Peter's been reading ahead, and which is allowed, but it's extra credit, actually. When we get to chapter 10, we will see that behind the rulers of the world are angelic agencies that are sometimes called princes, and these angels are at war with one another, and when an angel, when the angels go into battle, it can have to do with with one kingdom falling and another one rising in its place. So there is something going on in the behind the scenes all along as well, in the whole thing here. Now, I think what this chapter does, it makes world history much more dynamic and interesting. It's pretty hard to lock this into any set of existing powers, but it's very obvious the restructuring in the Middle East, all of the restructuring in Europe, all of the worldwide economic influences that move towards one world government are all in this ballpark here. Western civilization seems to be the one that dominates the world most of the time. Yeah.
So any commentators bring China into the picture?
Not here. In the Revelation, we have armies from the east invading the Middle East. But this seems to be... Bible prophecy seems to focus around the Mediterranean, around those nations that are immediately near Israel, that have the greatest... That's why it's pretty hard to put the U.S. in Bible prophecy. We're far away. So mostly Bible prophecy deals with those immediate nations right around Israel. We don't exist anymore. Well, we're Roman. We're certainly Roman in our government, in our economy, in our hedonism, love of pleasure, you know, our influence. This is one of the problems with the Muslims today is the Muslims are generally third world countries, and they're generally ruled over by dictators, and they haven't had a renaissance lately. And the Western nations have enjoyed all this power and all this wealth and all of this technology, and they feel left behind. Well, if Allah is their God, how come they're not winning? And there's this kind of collective inferiority complex in Islam. since Allah is supposed to be ruling the world, if we're not going to win this war by peaceful means, we better take to the sword. That's our mandate. And there's some really good books out on why the Muslims see themselves the way they do in general. They simply haven't kept up with the rest of the world in technology and economy and so on. Oh, please. The more the better. Yeah. In the Middle East, water and food are very central issues that play into the politics of the region, that very strongly so, yes. The distribution of food, the food supply for the world is, the U.S. food supply is only, it takes, 5% of our workforce to raise enough food for all of us? Whereas for our great-grandparents, everybody was farming. So food distribution becomes terribly important, especially for the developing nations. Communication links. So you get on a plane, the whole world's interconnected now. The banking systems are all interconnected. Sovereign boundaries between nations are very diffuse now. You can do all sorts of things that bypass any sovereign boundaries. If you want to do financial transactions halfway around the world with your other bank accounts, there's no control over that. So you've got these fuzzy boundaries. Now you've got global problems. Do you need a global police force? What's the U.S. doing halfway around the world involved in a war over in the Middle East? Why should we even be there? I mean, these are... people never thought this way 200 years ago. Money? Power? Yeah. And fragile. Oh yeah, it's driven by behind the scenes big international banking interests and power brokers that we know very little about. I'm not much into conspiracy theories. If you want some fun and see what kind of a radical I am, there's a website called tribwatch.com, and I'm written up there in 2 chapters as one of the key leaders in the Illuminati. And because of my work in Egypt and my affiliation with the Edgar Cayce Foundation, I am one of the really bad guys in today's world. And if you want to see how bad I am and all the secret things I'm doing, I wish I had some of the profits that all this should be yielding me. I believe in conspiracy theories, but I think that conspiracies come and go so quick that you can't ever pin them down. Then, if the world is really run by a big evil prince who is a master of deceit, then you have to believe the whole world is being managed by the Prince of Darkness. And the Prince of Darkness has got his hands in everything. And the King of Kings is going to come and supplant that, throw it all out, throw it all down, and you and I get to inherit. From Daniel, you don't see that you and I inherit the reign of the earth, but from the New Testament it's clear. The believers of Israel and the believers of the church rule and reign with Messiah when he comes. And he hasn't come yet in this definitive way. And when he does, all the kingdoms of the world will come under his dominion. There isn't very much that you keep from the old way of doing things. If this fourth beast is burned in the fire, and the statue was smashed in pieces, then the government Jesus brings will be a radically different kind of a whole world system with radical different rules. Yeah. Originally families. There's the saying back in Deuteronomy that God has appointed, I can't remember, originally the Jews think there originally were 70 nations named after 70 individuals that would be descendants of a patriarch. The 70 Jews that went into Egypt. Yeah, that's right. God has numbered the nations according to the 70 that went in. So traditionally 70 nations with sovereignty. So there is something in the Bible about nations having specific sovereign boundaries, and originally there'd be a head of a family over them. That'd be maybe the family and sons and grand ethnic groups. Yeah. Yeah, and the New Testament takes on the idea of who rules over, who has authority over somebody, legitimate or not. Yeah. Well, you know, the commentaries that you read take apart the Aramaic pretty carefully, and some of this is a little bit vague. You wish you could know a lot more. By the way, at the end of chapter 7 is where the Aramaic section stops, and starting in chapter 8 we go back to Hebrew again, which is probably significant. I wish you could dig more out of here, but you simply can't get much more out of the text as it is. Now, this is not the only time the Bible talks about these things. They all come up in the book of Revelation again. We're not through with Daniel yet. So, you have to hold this a little bit in tension. Yes, sir. Was the book of Daniel in the Dead Sea Scrolls? Peter would know that, but he's probably... I don't know. All of Isaiah was, the whole scroll of Isaiah was intact. If you go to the Museum of the Scrolls, you can go read all of Isaiah from start to finish in this big circle around. All the books but Esther. Oh, thank you very much. That's good. It's good. Well, we'll quit there. Now, in your notes today, you can read ahead, and then next time in 2 weeks, we'll look at chapter 8. Chapter 8 has got some of the same mystery in it. It's going to deal with the Medes and the Persians and with the Greeks in a little more detail. That's the verse I was trying to think of, yeah, according to how many sovereign nations there are. Okay, well, we'll quit and meet in 2 weeks, and that'll give you all time to read ahead and digest all this. Our Father, thank you for this absolutely fascinating, enigmatic portion of the Scriptures. It's really full of a lot of mystery the more we think about it. And I pray that we can think outside the box and yet not go overboard in wild directions. All kinds of people today are crazy prophecy nuts. And we'd like to be men and women who are mainstream, who've thought things through, who know how to interpret the Bible with the Bible and how to think soundly. But we want to be able also to be able to answer people who have, to whom this is unfamiliar territory. Father, we pray you would help us to understand the times in which we live, and not to try to force fit the Bible into the current part of history, but also to see the flow of things, to see the way things are merging and moving ahead. This is a great chapter because it gives us confidence that though there's hard times ahead for those who follow you and know you, your ultimate rule over the whole world is clearly here. The courts will come and sit in judgment, and the King of Kings will come and take the planet and rule the nations, and we are privileged to rule with him, and we'd like to be worthy of your trust and places of authority that you'd like to place us in. In the meantime, help us.